Now, did you think because the Christmas Day festivities have passed and the New Year's Eve ball has officially dropped that we were going to leave you hanging and not return with another episode to kick off 2025 in grand fashion? Well, if so, then you thought wrong, as we're back and set to provide you with all of our thoughts on the latest happenings around the NBA as you take the time to wind down from all the jubilee that made the New Year's Eve parties you attended worth your while. Happy New Year, everybody, and welcome inside to another episode of the New 24 podcast, episode 8 for everybody keeping up to date wherever you may be listening in from. As you know, that we truly appreciate you to the fullest. I'm your host, Gabriel Wilkins, and beside me, as always, is my co-host and the distinguished one himself, Torrence Stagger. The Christmas Day games, to the surprise of many, lived up to the hype. We also even saw a couple of squabbles take place on the court to the surprise and delight of some fans, as noticed across the reactions to the incidents on social media and whatnot as well, alongside a few go-ahead shots getting knocked down late in regulation to guide teams to pivotal victories that could prove to be monumental and will define the course of some seasons for some. How are you
We made
though, bro? Yes, we did. In last week's episode of the New 24 podcast, me and Torrence sought to examine the cases of several All-Stars whose names have surfaced across the radar of league scouts and executives as players that could potentially be moved prior to the trade deadline that's 36 days away, while also seeking to uncover which places might make for the best potential landing spots for them to end up in the event that they are moved within the coming weeks as the action on the marketplace continues to heat up. Now, we'll seek to examine a trio of teams in the Western Conference who all reside in the same state, as one recently made national headlines for making a change on the sidelines to the surprise of many a couple of days following Christmas, followed by a team in the Eastern Conference who is seeking to shock critics and make their first playoff appearance in 6 years after boasting the worst record in the NBA just a season ago. But before we get into all of the main topics, let's take some time, as we always do, to tip our cap to the association's premier performers with our opening tip-off segment, beginning with a pair of players who managed to provide the fans in Madison Square Garden with a Christmas Day classic that they'll never forget, in Victor Wembanyama for the San Antonio Spurs and Mikal Bridges of the New York Knicks, became the first pair of opposing players to each record 40-plus points in a Christmas Day album since 1961, as the NBA's reigning rookie of the year recorded a game-high 42 points and 18 boards in his Christmas debut for San Antonio. However, Wemby's spectacular efforts wouldn't be enough, as Bridges dropped a season-high 41 points en route to knocking down 6 triples to help New York rally back and earn a close win against the Spurs. In addition to a former star by the Bay Area who recently etched his name further in the record books, and that is Klay Thompson for the Dallas Mavericks, who passed the Hall of Famer and Indiana Pacers icon Reggie Miller on Christmas Day to move up to 5th place on the NBA's all-time three-pointers made list, as well as a native of the city we're recording from in Chicago, who was once a play-by-play man for the NBA on NBC in the mid-90s, in addition to the voice behind many various assignments and countless shows across CBS Sports, the late great Greg Gumbel, who passed away after a recent bout with cancer just last week at the age of 78. As our thoughts and prayers go out to his family. You know, Torrence, I usually open up the show each week by asking you what are the top things that stood out to you the most across the NBA landscape since our previous recording. However, with 2024 officially coming to a close, I like to switch it up a little bit to ask you, what were the top moments of players across the league that left quite an impression on you over the last 12 months that you won't forget when taking the time to reflect back on it in the years to come?
All right. At the top, I'm gonna start with LeBron James scoring 40,000 points back in March. I'm not gonna elaborate on that, but he's the first player to do that in NBA history. So, number two, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Jason Tatum was kind of like a topic on social media this week. You know, some reason he's always in comparison with Luka Doncic. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Joel Embiid, like the new crop of stars in the NBA. But to me, Jason Tatum has separated himself. especially finally winning the title. You talking about a guy who probably should have been a number one pick in the draft. He ended up being picked, what, three by the Boston Celtics. Markelle Fultz went one to the Sixers. Lonzo Ball went two to the Los Angeles Lakers. And the Sixers, they traded up to take Markelle Fultz. He's dealt with Kyrie Irving coming to the team and then leaving. Different cores, different coaches. And he's at 26. He has a lot of playoff experience. He finally has a ring. I think this season, if the Celtics manage to get the one seed, he should be the league MVP. So Jason Tatum this year definitely stamped himself. And Jaylen Brown also. Jaylen Brown, this is more of a futuristic thought, but his ability to step up during the NBA Finals and be the wingman to Jason Tatum, and unlike a Scottie Pippen or a Kyrie Irving or a Dwayne Wade or a Kobe Bryant when they were the quote-unquote sidekicks, Jaylen Brown actually won the MVP. Finals MVP and the Eastern Conference Finals MVP. So, really, it's more of a let's see what's to come with him, because his ability to, I would say, play his role but still grow his game could be the difference between the Celtics being one-time champions and potentially being a dynasty.
That's well said, Torrance, and I agree with you in regards to Boston. That was a team that really showed a tremendous amount of growth over the last year, and seeing them finally get over the hump was a special moment to me as well, considering all the playoff battles that they went through. We saw this team a couple years prior look like they were on the precipice of getting to that NBA championship, but they ran up against a team that had been there and done that before in the Golden State Warriors. And they've been through countless playoff battles, like you said, time and time again, but they fell short. However, with the dynamic duo in Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum alongside the new addition at last season, at least, and Kristaps Porzingis, they found a way to put it all together and bring it home. And that was real dope to see, especially when I can recall seeing Jason Tatum up close in person, not only when he was in high school, deal with the pressure of being a top five player in the country, but going from that to Duke and then to Boston his rookie year and making an immediate impact. And now you look at his resume, we talk about a five-time NBA All-Star, a guy that's won All-Star Game MVP, a guy that's been named to the All-NBA first team three times. And at the age of 26, like you said, has a very impressive resume and has done everything that there is to do in the game, really, outside of winning MVP award. And I believe even if the Celtics stay within the top two of the East, which they will, if he puts up the numbers that are good enough to warrant it, that he should be the MVP of the league. That's just my opinion. You know,
Donovan Mitchell. I'm going to give it to Donovan Mitchell in that scenario.
That's fine. Donovan Mitchell is just as deserving of MVP votes, but you have other guys like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander that's on a tear right now that's going to have something to say about that, alongside of Nikola Jokic of the Denver Nuggets as well, putting up historic numbers. I don't agree that he should be the MVP either, but he's going to be in the thick of the conversation. Now, in regards to top moments for players across the league that left an impression on me over the last 12 months, I'd have to say the guy that really stood out to me was Anthony Edwards of the Minnesota Timberwolves. Here's a guy that last year guided Minnesota to a top three seed in the Western Conference. And a lot of people didn't expect that from them, and managed to go on a playoff journey that stood out. And it's not every day you see guys in only just their third playoff appearance go from winning a first round series, which is a major landmark in his career, but also knocking off the defending world champions in the Denver Nuggets in a seven-game series that went down to the wire. And at one point in time, the Timberwolves were down as many as 19 points. And although he struggled and received help from his supporting cast at the time, such as Carl Anthony Towns, Jay McDaniels, Naz Reid, and the like, when he hit that big shot in the corner and, you know, was talking this shit to the Denver crowd, that was a moment that I'd never forget. And it was real cool to see his growth and transformation. He put Minnesota back in the forefront in a way that I hadn't seen them since the days of Kevin Garnett. when I was an 11-year-old. And that was very fun to witness, man, and behold, as a fan of the game and as a spectator of the game. You never know what the future holds for certain guys, but for him to be able to have that moment, a moment that I believe was a pivotal one in his career, it made me excited to see just how far he could continue to go in his growth and development alongside of a Minnesota Timberwolves team, albeit with some changes, still will have a bright future as long as number five is around.
His shoe, too. His shoe.
Yeah, for
like,
sure. He had to shoe of the year. Great marketing campaign.
Well, yeah, the marketing campaign, because, like, man, besides what, KD and LeBron, there really hasn't been a signature shoe that really has just, like, stuck around, like, for real. Like, okay, you see Harden shoe, you see Jason Tatum shoe, you see Lillard, Derrick Rose had a, like, I know people that they would buy like D Rose shoes, but like Anthony Edwards, he kind of like really created some organic hype around his shoe. You know, I've never seen a shoe, a sign, like we on the second season of the same shoe. Like they ran the same shoe back again. So that means he might actually be following in Michael Jordan footsteps. We might actually see the AE2 probably at the All-Star game this year. And like, yeah, I just think that was a cool moment for 2024. Like for real, like just off the court, like really bringing back hype around signature shoes. Cause now I'm more in tune to see what Jason Tatum's next shoe looks like, what Luka's shoe looks like. And WNBA, they got Sabrina has a shoe. Caitlin Clark has a shoe coming. Angel Reese, Aja Wilson. So we got a whole new like generation of signature shoes and signature athletes coming. And I think AE broke the mold and Kanye broke the mold because, I mean, that shoe's basically a Yeezy and that might be the hold up for the AE too.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, but I was excited just to see it. And yeah, his campaign with Adidas was one of the best sneaker campaigns that I've seen for a sneaker, especially a debut sneaker, within the last 20 plus years. And it was cool to see him and his friend Nick Maddox, you know, involved in it. I see he even had a shoe where he allowed Nick to make his little personalized edition or twist on the AE1 that dropped a couple weeks prior to Christmas. And that was real fun to see. And I believe he wore it a couple of games prior to Christmas Day as well. And they're actually in Timberwolves colors. So I know just watching the season that he had combined with the marketing campaign, it made you want to see when he was in the playoffs just how far he could guide a Minnesota Timberwolves squad to
that makes it a classic shoe
to the playoff. Yeah,
the
oh,
more,
for
the
sure.
More, the more you see somebody do something in the shoe that adds to the legacy of the shoe. Like, and from the high top to the low top, like he was actually able to balance both of them, which was like real cool to see. But let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
You said what was your favorite shoe campaign? And I'll give you mine.
My favorite shoe campaign, like in my lifetime.
Yeah, what you gonna tell me about Magic and Bird, nigga?
I like the campaign for the LeBron fours.
Yeah, I think we might be talking about the same campaign, maybe.
When he had like the LeBron series.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it was different variations of LeBron.
Yeah,
I enjoyed that one.
The one with the pool. The one with the pool.
Yeah,
that was crazy.
I enjoyed that one. As a kid, I always enjoyed the little penny commercials with Nike. I actually Indeed. Have a little penny now still to this day, like in an office space.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Man, you kind of took my answer with that LeBron one. The Bernie Mac one was cool with the church. That was cool because that was cool. He had like all the gear when that first dropped. He had his own basketball jumpsuit, all that. That was crazy. I don't remember Melo really having no shoe campaigns, no D Wade.
Melo had one with Tommy Davis.
I don't remember that. I gotta go
back in
check.
The day.
I'm gonna have to go check that one out. Tommy Davis and Melo don't even make sense together.
Yeah,
see,
yeah.
that's why it ain't no more. You're just doing something. I like to see James Harden have a cool commercial. Like for real. Like I think James Harden should have like a cool lifestyle commercial.
And then I say another campaign that stood out to me. It was prior to Jordan's, like, last year. It might have been his last season with the Bulls, where he was playing like a myriad of like characters in like 1930s, 1940s film. And like one of the scenes involved him like
Right.
doing the jump man over the border trade.
I don't know. I don't remember that commercial, but all you telling me is Mike had on some big suits. Like, that was a
Yeah,
regular
he
day for
did.
him.
Yeah,
He wasn't dressing up.
he definitely had that, but he still had the aura around him, you know, at the time to where, you know, he could pull that off without, like, this was
He
before memes and stuff became a
had the
thing.
aura. That's crazy. He had the aura. That's crazy.
He did. And then another guy that stood out to
He
me,
freaking doubled down.
another guy that stood out to me in 2024, who happened to win a gold medal with Team USA, even though he wasn't the main star, I would say, in the Paris games, is Kevin Durant. I just really appreciate Kevin Durant's ability to engage with fans and connect with fans during these times. I know it may not always be the easiest for athletes to do that. However, he's made himself accessible in a way that a lot of stars haven't by openly engaging in dialogue with fans about the game. I mean, how many all-star players do you know are willing to step into spaces for a man on X, have a conversation with you about your thoughts on the game, and maybe challenge your perspective or force you to see something from the vantage point of a player that you might not always have access to? I appreciate that from him. And I think he's making himself a very unique figure from the standpoint, as opposed to his peers, is he's embracing the opportunity to be an ambassador of basketball. And he's giving back to the next generation by doing that, I think, in a great way, while also enlightening fans in ways where he's not trying to come off as though he's holier than thou, but just trying to get you to see it from where he's coming from.
Oh man, KD definitely got some Roger Mayweather in him. He definitely be letting people know that they don't know what they're talking about. We ain't about to give him the humble role. You say that for you. We ain't,
I mean, he ain't fully
nah.
humble, but then again, at the same time,
He just a laid back dude, but we ain't gonna just play it like he don't be talking his shit though. But well, this is what I wanna say.
he's earned that right. I mean,
This,
I
of
don't knock him if he
course.
wants to.
But this is what I will say about Kevin Durant, and this might be an important distinction for basketball going forward. Was KD just won what his fourth Olympic gold medal? So that make he has the most gold medals in Olympic basketball history. You also talk about somebody that got drafted in 07, what, 4 years after LeBron. So he became almost like the new car model. You got a bunch of 7-footers that play like Kevin Durant. You got Victor Wembanyama, who you hear his height and everybody wants him to be Shaq and Wilt Chamberlain. But you listen to him talk, you watch him play, and he's an evolution of Kevin Durant in the same way LeBron was an evolution of Magic Johnson, in the same way Kobe was an evolution of Michael Jordan. And when you hear what Vic had to say after the Olympics, that was pretty much his main goal. He'd rather have a gold medal than he would an NBA championship, because that is the one the world's best plays. And for Kevin Durant to be looked at as the GOAT by a lot of the new players coming in the league, and for him to be the guy with the most gold medals, and the way he's playing, he might be on the 2028 team. That might be his farewell tour. I mean, like, I don't know. I just really want to get KD his due, because that Golden State situation just kind of like changed the narrative on him in a way where it's crazy, because KD is definitely no less than top 10 like best basketball players ever. And
Yeah, I don't disagree.
if you ever hear players talk, they tell you that he actually might be the most talented player of all time.
Definitely a ball player that's worth the price of admission to watch play live too, with the best seat in the house if you had the ability to do it. I had a chance to check him out before he left Brooklyn over a year ago, and it was a very spectacular scene to watch. You know, the way he's able to get to his spots, and you can't really speed him up or slow him down. It was a performance that I definitely appreciated, and I wish I definitely would have got a chance to see him a lot sooner. But the fact that his game continues to age like fine wine, it makes you wonder sometimes just how much longer he can continue to play. Because if he continues to play at the level that he's been playing at, man, he might join or get close to that 40,000 point club alongside of LeBron someday. But I want to move away from briefly highlighting the week's marquee stars and the moments that define the last 365 days, 366 days, because 2024 was a leap year, to discuss a recent story that managed to captivate many around the league this past Friday out in the capital of California, where the Sacramento Kings fired their head coach, Mike Brown, less than halfway through his third year with the club while they were in the midst of a five-game losing streak. Brown, who won Coach of the Year honors in his first season in Sacramento back in 2023, was informed of the news as he was driving to the team plane for a flight to Los Angeles, according to several reports. The 54-year-old had a 107-88 record in two-plus seasons in Sacramento, with a winning record in both of his full seasons. Joining the Hall of Famer Rick Adelman is the only other coach in franchise history to ever generate a winning record in a season since the Kings moved to Sacramento. Assistant coach Doug Christie will take over the reins as the interim coach. Torrance, Brown's sudden firing happened to come at a time when Sacramento was currently in the midst of their longest losing streak in nearly 2 years and lost an NBA worst 9 games this season after leading in the fourth quarter, with the most recent one coming in Brown's final game as a head coach against a team we'll discuss later on in this week's episode. Brown had recently signed a 3-year extension through 2027 to remain with the Kings this past June, so he'll be compensated well nonetheless. But when you look at Sacramento's situation from the top down, you hear all the recent reports out there over the last several days, who do you believe is truly at fault for their most recent woes as of late?
Oh man, the owner Vivek and De'Aaron Fox.
Do you care to elaborate on that?
I mean, look, man, if we gonna get into it, we can just get into it. De'Aaron Fox is pretty much halfway in, halfway out with the Sacramento Kings, right? There's rumors that he might want to go to a team like the Houston Rockets, the San Antonio Spurs, so on and so forth. He believes that he's underrated. You know, he's not on national games. He wants to be able to play deeper into the playoffs. You know, he just wants his just due, and he's curious to know if he could do it in Sacramento. You bring in DeMar DeRozan. Not quite the best fit this season. They blame the coach. But De'Aaron Fox is the guy who made the key mistake a few games ago, fouling the jump shooter on the three and causing a 4-point play. Mike Brown calls him out about it in the press conference. Mike Brown is fired the next day. That's a coach just calling it like it is, like we all saw it. But this is how the owner comes into play because he wants to keep his superstar. We know how the storyline works in the NBA. First, it's the coach, then it's a trade, then it's a GM, and then we get to the superstar. Owner never leaves. But he wants to keep De'Aaron Fox. But at the same time, if you De'Aaron Fox, you're not a household name. You don't have a lot of playoff success, but you're trying to stick the Kings up for as much money as possible. And this is how you do it. What's the damn word? Delegating the blame around. Coach. Hey, next he gonna tell the truth and say, look, man, we need a better big in the middle other than Domantas Sabonis. He put up good numbers. But come on, man, what are you doing with Jokic? What are you doing with Anthony Davis? Shit, what are you doing with Draymond? What are you doing with Chet? Like, what are you doing with Zion? What are you doing with Derek Lively and Gafford? Like, I mean, only guy he could probably match up with is Nurkic. And Phoenix trying to get rid of him. So it's really like a game of cat and mouse with this contract negotiation with De'Aaron Fox and Vivek that's like really affecting the Kings for real. Because you can go one of two directions, and they're clearly going in one direction. And I'm sure we'll get to that in the next few months.
When I look at Sacramento's situation, it's a lot of people at fault. But Mike Brown should not be the fall guy for it. And I agree with you. It's Vivek Rana Dibe, the owner of the Kings. He's one of them. And De'Aaron Fox has to take some blame as well, because I don't understand how you can continuously take the criticism of a coach that you know has been there for your growth and development to the level in which you did, because that wasn't the first time that De'Aaron Fox got called out by Mike Brown. Mike Brown been doing this for the last few years in Sacramento. But De'Aaron Fox, to his credit, was very receptive of that. Now, like you talked about, Torrence, guys in search of a new deal, has new representation, just recently got his own shoe deal, is part of Stephen Curry's brand on Under Armour. Like, hey, he want that profile. But to whom much is given, much is required. I look at Sacramento's situation, and I see a team that didn't necessarily, or front office rather, that didn't necessarily know their personnel. Sacramento's greatest strength over the last 3 years under Mike Brown has been their offense. They've always boasted top 10 offense. They can score with the best of them. The issue was always the defensive side of the ball. And a lot of that stems from the personnel in which they have on their roster. Domantas Sabonis, as great as he is an orchestrator and a playmaker out of pick and rolls and in the low post, and can put up 20, 10, and 5 easily. He's not known for being a shutdown defender or a guy that gets up, for being a high energy impact defender on that side of the ball. He's not known for that. Moreover, it was some things that they did with the way in which they constructed their roster, like giving Harrison Barnes a extension. That was questionable. You trade him. You try to bring in DeMar DeRozan. When you bring in DeMar DeRozan, you go into the training camp saying, well, the expectation is to make it to the playoffs. But you never ever shore it up. The one issue that you've always had, and that's your defense, your team defense. And Domantas Sabonis, as great as he is, maybe he's a four instead of a five. However, we'll never know that in Sacramento because they never ever sought to address the center position. Like in the closing minutes of the game that we'll get into a little bit later when we bring up that team to talk about them on the latter portion of the show, the Kings had Alex Len in. And no disrespect to Alex Len, but that's not your guy that you want to be playing heavy minutes at the five. He's more of your backup option. I look at everybody is being at fault in this predicament. And the front office has to take some blame as well, because you can't just make haphazard decisions when you know the limitation that your roster has.
So let me ask you, do you feel like at this point in the season, you put in Doug Christie as the interim coach? You got the De'Aaron Fox contract situation looming. DeMar DeRozan has a new deal, but it's only $23 million. So it's kind of movable. And the rumor out there is that Mike Brown wanted him to come off the bench because
Right.
DeMar don't play the way the Kings play. The Kings did a lot of like dribble handoffs, a lot of ball movement, and we know DeMar, he's a one-on-one isolation scorer.
Yes,
He
he
can
is.
handle the ball, he can make plays for others too, so I don't want to downplay that part of his game. But when it comes to putting the ball in the basket, he's more of a solo artist. So, do you believe that the Kings at this point, do you think they need to start trading to win games to get back into the play-in hunt to make the playoffs? Or do you feel like they should trade De'Aaron Fox and then begin to just start this whole thing over again?
When I look at Sacramento's roster right now and the state in which they're in, if guys not willing to buy in, you're gonna have to think about letting pieces go in an attempt to build a better pathway towards contending in the future. And yeah, I do believe that DeMar DeRozan got in the way in which the Kings offense likes to play, because like you said, they like to play the dribble handoff. They're up tempo type of team. As soon as they get a rebound, they want to push and run and gun and attack. They've been able to do that in the minutes without DeMar. But DeMar is what coaches nowadays would deem as a ball stopper, similar to what you described Brandon Ingram as in last week's episode. We were talking about players that could be moved at the trade deadline, like a guy that, if it was the mid-2000s or the early 2000s era, he would be widely appreciated, or even like the late 90s. But now he's not appreciated in an era where pace and space has become king. So yeah, I would seek to sell pieces on their roster. If you're going to trade De'Aaron Fox away, you might as well trade DeMar DeRozan away. You also might as well trade Malik Monk away, who's a guy that you're going to see surface in a lot of trade rumors if Sacramento continues to play at the course that they're currently on.
See, the funny part about this is, in theory, maybe they should move on from De'Aaron Fox, but they got to ride this out because they don't know when they're going to have their next chance at a De'Aaron Fox. Like, it's Sacramento. And
Right.
also to shoot them a little bell, they're in the same division as the Golden State Warriors, the Los Angeles Lakers, the Clippers, and the Phoenix Suns. Somebody got to miss the playoffs in that division. And if you talk about free agent destinations, people would rather be in LA, Phoenix, and the Bay, I would assume. So they playing with their hands tied behind their back. So at this point, they have to keep a De'Aaron Fox.
Yeah, I think they're gonna keep him, barring a massive,
And miss the playoffs. That's the crazy part.
I think and that's true too. They very well can miss the playoffs, but I think they're gonna keep him because they've invested so much into this year. Going into this season, it was playoffs or bust. We lost to New Orleans in the play-in a season ago. We're trying to find a way to get back, but then again, you had the coach that got you back for the first time in almost 20 years, got you to win the game of reaching the Western Conference semifinals a couple seasons ago, and all of a sudden, you want to bail out with him and hop out the ride that he took you on, and you still were boasting, might I add, a top 10 offense under his leadership.
Yeah, and somebody mentioned this to me. I'm gonna just my cousin, he mentioned this to me. He was like, yeah, he said that he feels like DeMar DeRozan took away from Keegan Murray's development. And when you say bring up Mike Brown in the top 10 offense, like you said, this wasn't the problem. So it's like you brought in a piece that just made things awkward. But if they were maybe a smarter franchise, they may have been looking to move DeMar for that big that you said that they need. That's obviously the move to make. You know, maybe you get a big that's more willing to come off the bench, you know, from a team. I mean, I haven't looked into it, but let's just say a guy like Robert Williams or Mitchell Robinson, you know, somebody that might have injuries or something. So, hey, telling you to come off the bench, not that big of a deal. And
Right.
DeMar can help a contender because he might be more willing to come off the bench at that point. I got my money. I know how the league looking at me now. And they telling me I can do my thing off the bench, then that might be the thing to do. But this is the Sacramento Kings and they do dumb shit. So at this point, I'm expecting them to do nothing.
And it's interesting how you say your cousin was allude
And
to
Tyrese, shout out
the
to him.
move. Shout out to Tyrese. You was talking about how he said the move to get a guy like DeMar DeRozan impacted Keegan Murray's development. Last year, Keegan Murray averaged 15.2 points per game with almost 6 rebounds a game. He was shooting 35% from 3-point land. shot 45% from the field. Thus far this season, through 32 games, those numbers have decreased. He's averaging close to 12 points a game, yet a rebound is picked up to nearly 7.5, but he's shooting under 30% from three, and he's shooting 41.3% from the field. And when you put all that into perspective, that's a far cry from a guy who, in his first 2 years in the league, was never shooting below 35% from three. His rookie year, if I'm not mistaken, I had the numbers up in front of me, he made 206 triples, which I believe was a record at the time for a rookie. So it still may be a record. So when you put that into perspective, yeah, I can see why your cousin would think that way, because he – and then on top of that, he moved him to the fourth spot. And I don't think Keegan Murray is a guy that is best suited at the four. I think he's a guy that's better suited at the three, which is where he's playing through his first 2 years in Sacramento. And I wouldn't mind him going after a guy like Rob Williams to start. Mitchell Robinson would be a godsend for them in their defense. You put him beside Sabonis and move Sabonis to the four, you can make some things happen. I don't think that they're going to just make trades for the sake of making trades. I think Fox will stay put, but if this does not work this summer, yeah, you have to make some trades, and you're going to have to wipe your hands clean with a few guys and say, hey, it was nice knowing you.
Yeah, I was about to say, De'Aaron taking that Supermax if they offering it. He can play like he want to leave. You know, that's a part of the negotiation. They offering him that Supermax money, he gonna sign that deal.
And he probably should, because he ain't going to get it nowhere else like he'll get it there. But at the same time, I'm looking at everything from the top down, not just from De'Aaron's standpoint, but just from the organizational standpoint. And I'm just like, what the hell is going on? Because a couple of seasons ago, the Kings had managed to shock many around the league. They won 48 games to grab the third seed in the West during Brown's inaugural season at the helm, to end the NBA's longest playoff drought in 16 seasons. And then they fell short of getting out the first round, as I mentioned earlier, and then falling to Golden State in a thrilling seven-game series. However, this led to a lot of short-term expectations growing larger than ever in the years to follow, as we talked about. As the front office group there made it clear with the sign and trade for DeMar DeRozan this summer that they expected to make the playoffs once again. You look at Mike Brown's situation in Sacramento. Do you believe that it's safe to say that he became a falling casualty due to the immediate success that he delivered the Kings upon his arrival? And for those that don't know out there, before you answer to it, Brown is the second Coach of the Year recipient in the last three seasons that happened to get fired by the franchise in which he won Coach of the Year with.
Look, after everything we just named, of course it wasn't his fault. But somebody got to take the blame. This is the NBA way. Mike Brown been through this before, man. He done been fired because somebody got to take the blame. You know? And like De'Aaron Fox said, hey, man, you still getting paid. And you might end up in a better situation because y'all not winning shit in Sacramento. And a guy like that deserves to add his knowledge of the game to somewhere else. Like, he was an assistant on the Golden State Warriors. He coached LeBron James. He coached Kobe Bryant. He comes from the San Antonio Spurs coaching tree. So, I mean, this a guy with incredible basketball knowledge. Like, I'm not a coach. You know, I'm not going to ever pretend that I know more about the game than these guys. You know, do I see things that I might disagree with? Of course, but I'm just a fan at the end of the day. But a guy like Mike Brown, I can't say he got a raw deal, but somebody just had to take the blame. Just how it go. They DeMar trading DeMar DeRozan. I love DeMar DeRozan. That's clearly the difference with the team. But we can't do that, because then that means somebody else got to admit to making a mistake, and it ain't their turn yet.
It's someone that has had the privilege of seeing some internal structure within organizations, I gotta say it. Mike Brown was a fallen casualty, or he at least became one. in this situation. And yeah, you're right, Torrance. Someone does have to take the blame. And it is unfortunate that Mike Brown is one of those guys. And like you said, he has a hell of a track record, a hell of a resume. And we know that he'll be back in the league again, whether it's as an assistant coach or whether it's as a head coach with another organization. However, I think a lot of times when organizations find success immediately following change, they're quick to jump the gun and assume because they find that success that they're just a step or two close to a championship. And it's not always like that. You know, it's 30 teams in the NBA, and it's only a handful of teams each year that go in with a legitimate shot of winning an NBA championship. The Sacramento Kings, with the exception of maybe the 2001-2002 season, have not been among the top four in the NBA where for a prolonged period enough to say, well, you know what? We have what it takes to win a championship. I think Mike Brown did an impressive job with the Kings organization. And I believe that he should have had the opportunity to see the season through because there was still a lot of games left to be played. You know, I'm not going to sit up and say that someone deserves, even though I may feel that way, but I do believe he became a fallen casualty. And I do think it's unfortunate that coaches have to go through that in today's game, especially when you want to have as much time as you possibly can to build a culture that is sustainable and that promotes and induces winning.
And I just want to mention that what Monty Williams was the coach of the Phoenix Suns. He won Coach of the Year. He was fired like the next year. The same thing happened in 2018 with Dwayne Casey, Toronto Raptors. They lost in the playoffs. He was fired the year after winning the Coach of the Year. And I mean, we're not gonna point out the obvious common denominator between these three guys, but I mean, that's something that got to be fought for more in the league too, man. A lot of these black coaches, I'm gonna just go and say it now. Fuck it.
Don't say
A
it.
lot of these black coaches, man, they always got to take over these shit teams. They build them up. They get to a certain level, like maybe second round exit, the occasional conference finals, like a Dwayne Casey. And then they get fired. You know? And like sometimes they don't get another good job. 'Cause what? Monty Williams, he left the Phoenix Suns. He had to go to the Detroit Pistons. Ironically enough, Dwayne Casey got fired and he had to go where? To the
Detroit
Detroit
Pistons.
Pistons. Like, come on, man. Like it's just too obvious. You know what I'm saying? You gotta deal with the bullshit to get nothing in the end. Hey, everybody just they I guess, you know, tap them on their back and let them know you still getting paid and you got a chance to live your dream out.
Exactly. And that's why I said I don't think that it's fair for coaches to go through that in today's game, and especially black coaches, because we had a season not too long ago where three out of the four coaches represented in the Eastern and Western Conference Finals were black. And once that happened, it was interesting to see how the league shifted. We started getting more of an influx of black coaches when people started talking about it and speaking about it the way that it should have been spoken about.
No, for sure.
But I want to move the show along from the discussion of circumstances out in Sacramento over to Los Angeles, where the franchise with the second most championships in NBA history recently made a trade at the top of the week to bring in a vital reinforcement on the wing in an effort to help supplement their defense. After being expected by most to be rather active on the trade market, the Lakers finally will prove beliefs to be true by sending D'Angelo Russell and 3 second-round picks over to the Brooklyn Nets in exchange for Dorian Finney-Smith and Shake Milton. Finney-Smith Starred in Dallas for 6.5 seasons, averaged 10.4 points per game through 20 contests this season for Brooklyn, while shooting almost 44% from downtown. Torrence, although this may not have been the big blockbuster move that most Lakers fans may have wanted, and we discussed it amongst ourselves once it went down, what are your overall thoughts on this move as it pertains to the purple and gold?
Man, that's a simple trade. Dorian Finney-Smith, on paper, he's the traditional 3-and-D guy. You know, come in, play some defense, guard the threes, guard the power forwards on the switch, could even, like, handle a possession or two guarding the opposing center. Now, my problem with this is these guys always come to the Lakers. Torian Prince. Jared Vanderbilt, so just so on and so forth. I'm not gonna, it's been a lot of trades like during the LeBron era with the Los Angeles Lakers. They hyped up to hit these threes, they never hit the fucking three. You know what I'm saying? Like, they never hit the fucking threes. We like it's always the same thing. But I will say this, JJ Redick, the one thing I've seen is he's not afraid to show who his favorites on the team are. And those guys have been performing very well under him. D'Angelo Russell got traded because he's felt like Austin Reeves is a great ball handler and a great playmaker. So you've essentially moved Austin Reeves to the point guard position. And between me and you in conversations we had earlier in the season, I said, man, the Lakers moving the ball well at the beginning of the season. Everybody touching it, everybody coming down with it. But I said, how long is LeBron going to actually allow that to happen before he decide he need to play point guard again? And we've getting through a third of the season. And when Austin Reeves ain't got it, LeBron playing point guard. And AD, he's doing a little point guard action in the half court. So, man, there was no room for D'Lo. He wasn't he up and down shooter, inconsistent turnovers, and the Lakers needed another wing that could defend because at this stage of his career, Bron ain't guarding nobody, you know, unless he really locked into that game.
Absolutely. And I think my thoughts on the move is, like you said, they're getting a 3-and-D wing. The question is always in Los Angeles, can he shoot? And, you know, sometimes for certain guys, when they playing in the City of Angels, those lights get too bright. You know, when you putting on that purple and gold uniform, everybody is watching you, not just in Los Angeles, but across the country. And we've seen that in regards to a player who we'll get into a little bit later on in the show, who recently started in Los Angeles not too long ago and came in with a reputable background for being one of the game's premier shooters. However, when he got over there, he was cold and he never was able to really find his
Who?
footing. I said we'll get to him later on in the show.
Why?
Well,
Why is
we
it a
talking about a brief.
why is
I'm
it a big
previewing.
mystery? What's a
I'm
big mystery?
previewing. I'm previewing. That's part of the show. We gotta keep the audience engaged. But when I look at the Lakers, man, my overall thoughts on it is they got a 3-and-D wing, a guy that's gonna come in there and really play the Jared Vanderbilt role, except he actually can shoot and or has been a reputable shooter. And it just remains to be seen how he's gonna fit, whether or not he's gonna start consistently, or is he gonna come off the bench? I think it does show the amount of trust that J.J. Redick has in Austin Reaves, who as of late has done an exceptional job of getting downhill, finding shooters on the perimeter, as well as getting to the rim and getting buckets in his own right. I believe he's been putting up like 20-7 over the last like 8 games since they switched up their starting lineup. So I'm curious to see how much longer Austin Reaves can continue to keep that up, because he definitely will be the secondary initiator and creator in this offense alongside of LeBron James, who, as we know, when he's out there for the majority of the time, is not seeking to come off the ball for anybody and is always seeking to be the orchestrator and the conductor of any offense that he's leading.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And
I
at the
like.
top, oh, go ahead, my bad.
No, you go.
No, you got something to add to it, go right ahead.
Nah.
Well, at the top of the week, Lakers head coach J.J. Redick, who played beside Finney Smith in Dallas, as well as Shake Milton during his time in Philadelphia, told reporters that he will continue to stick with the current lineup of Max Christie, Austin Reaves, Rui Hachimura, LeBron James, and Anthony Davis, and that he informed Finney Smith that he will be coming off the bench in Los Angeles for the time being. Redick also said that he will continue to evaluate the Lakers' starting lineup as well. However, the Lakers have posted a 6-2 record since the insertion of Christie into their starting five as of this recording, as they currently have a matchup on the horizon against the Cavs, who boast the NBA's best record at 28-4. When you look at the Lakers' current starting five unit and the success they've had to date in a limited sample size, what do you think has led to the instant turnaround?
I mean, the whole point of the trade, man. We moved D'Lo out the way, man. We can't just keep having bad defenders out there. Austin Reaves is not a great defender. D'Lo's not a great defender. LeBron, he ain't always rotating like all. He's not always rotating all the time. So adding a guy like Max Christie, like it makes a big difference in that lineup. Now you got somebody that you can make a primary defender. He got young legs. We not asking you to carry the load offensively. I think that's really been the big difference. That's the reason why they signed guys like Gabe Vincent, supposedly Jared Vanderbilt. Max Christie has been able to fill that slot, you know, while he's still developing his offensive game.
Yeah, Max Christie over the last few games, he scored at least 16 points or more in each of the Lakers' past three games. And you add that on top of the two-way presence that he provides, is the results have been there. And he's made an immediate impact. And it's been even cool to see that because I don't know if most people remember, but he struggled early on during the season. Like he was shooting 25% from three in October. Shot 31% in November. And even though there were flashes of like greatness that you could see in November, including a few games where he scored in double figures, it was a lot of up and down with him. Now he's starting to develop some consistency. And he's a guy that I always wanted to see in the rotation personally during the days when Darvin Ham was the coach, but we would see him sporadically. JJ putting his trust in him, I got to give him a lot of credit for doing that. Especially with him being a young player, but he's finding success in that role. And now that he's starting, it seems like it's really got him to amp up a little bit and do what needs to be done. And hopefully he continue to keep that up. Gabe Vincent has even played a little bit better off the bench as well as of late, considering the slow start he had. He's been shooting the ball a lot better. But I see that they got Shake Milton as well. And I'm wondering if Shake Milton could possibly be the Gabe Vincent replacement somewhat because if you look at the numbers of the stats, he's been shooting the ball better from three-point land. He's getting a little bit more of a spark off the bench offensively, in my opinion, than Gabe Vincent can.
No, I'm pro trading Gabe Vincent. I ain't got, you know.
It's funny you say that because, like, we talking about a Lakers roster that I don't think anyone would label as an instant championship contender in the wake of this trade. And this is a team that can't seem to stand pat with LeBron James, who is now 40 years old on the roster beside his front court running mate, Anthony Davis. Despite playing at a high level at the age of 31, we know he has an extensive injury history. And that leads many to wonder if his days at the peak of his power could come to a close. We know that they're going to make an effort to at least put a competitive roster around their all-star duo, especially with LeBron James still intact. Do you expect the Lakers to make another move prior to the conclusion of the trade deadline? And if so, which position do you believe they will look to address with that move?
I mean, I don't believe the Lakers will actually end up making another move, but maybe that's me being biased because I watch them all the time. But if they able to get Jared Vanderbilt and Gabe Vincent in some type of deal and bring back a five man to put next to Anthony Davis, that would be the most ideal situation because That's how the Lakers won the title in 2020, and that was what, 4 or 5 years ago at this point, and everybody keeps bringing up the same redundant point, but it was true. Hey, they played great because they were bigger than everybody. Like, if they wanted to go NBA 2K style, at one point they could have put LeBron at the one, Kyle Kuzma at the two, AD at the three, and Dwight and JaVale McGee at the four and five. And you wouldn't be able to go anywhere against that team offensively, because everybody could switch and rotate. They were just bigger than everybody. That's how you unlock Anthony Davis. You take possibly the best post defender in the league, guy's rim protector. Now he's able to play more free safety while somebody else guards a Nikola Jokic or Joel Embiid, and he can clean up all the other mess and have the support. Somebody else that can do the bulk of the boxing out for rebounds.
You know, you brought up Rob Williams earlier as a guy that would be a hell of a fit for the Sacramento Kings. I feel like Rob Williams would be the best fit for the Los Angeles Lakers. And although you've seen Jonas Valanciunas' name linked to the Lakers in a lot of reports, the only reason why I would push back to that, as much as I think he could be a force on the boards beside AD, he doesn't have the lateral movement to really, like, stick and hold his own on a lot of these pick-and-roll switches, which you know teams will seek to hunt him down on in a best-of-seven series. Robert Williams, on the other hand, based off of what I've seen during his time in Boston, I believe that he will have that energy and ability to do that, because he's shown it and he's proven that in postseasons of recent. And they need a guy like that beside of Anthony Davis to unlock another element to not only their offense, but defense as well, because that's going to be critical as to whether or not they can actually go on a deep run in the Western Conference, similar to how they did a couple of seasons ago in 2023 against the Denver Nuggets, and then a few years prior, like you mentioned, when they won it all in 2020 in the bubble. You know, they got to have that big there, man.
I mean, the reason they keep bringing up Valanciunas is because if you look at the analytics, you look at the per 36 stats, Valanciunas is third in rebounds in the league right this season.
Yes, he is.
You know, so at this point, when you look at the league, you just bust down the minutes like you would any other thing. You got your starters playing 32 to 40 minutes. Everybody else that's coming in the game, best case scenario, they are specialists. So, yeah, Valanciunas might not fit defensively always as far as his lateral movement, but when you're coming in a game to guard a team's other center that's probably not perimeter-based, more of a beast in the middle, so to speak, then that's when he can come in and give you the 12 to 16 minutes to relieve Anthony Davis and LeBron of having to, like, handle rebounding duties, because the Lakers give up a lot of second chance points.
That's true.
And it's always the threes that bite them in the ass, because they can't respond on the other end to hit the threes. So Valanciunas, like, yeah, he comes with some flaws, but he's also an upgrade in a lot of ways.
Oh, for sure. I'm not saying that I would be totally against it if they got Valanciunas, but I do know, I just believe that it would be some downsides to it slightly. And I just think Rob Williams would be the more ideal fit in their rotation. But you talk about how the Lakers have a bad habit of giving up second chance points and lead to a lot of wide open threes for the opposition. I saw that firsthand when they played the Atlanta Hawks a few weeks ago. And that's something that Dominique Wilkins in the Hawks broadcast, the color commentator over there, was alluding to, about how the Lakers got a bad habit of that, and that's something that they got to clean up if they really want to go to another level in a Western Conference that, as we know, is going to be stacked. Carrying on from all the Lakers chatter, to highlight a team they once played beside in downtown Los Angeles, but now resides 25 minutes out in Inglewood, and that's the LA Clippers. recently received positive news pertaining to one of the NBA's premier stars. According to Law Murray of The Athletic, Kawhi Leonard is targeting the Clippers game against the Atlanta Hawks on January the 4th, the day he will be set to make his official season debut after missing over 30-plus games to start the season due to inflammation in his right knee. As a two-time NBA Finals MVP, he's been quietly ramping up behind the scenes and also recently practiced with the Clippers G League affiliate in San Diego this weekend as part of his rehab program to make his anticipated return. The Clippers currently sit just a half a game out of the fourth seed in the West as of this recording, with 19-13 record. They currently are in the midst of a three-game road trip with games against the Spurs and Thunder on the horizon before facing off against the Hawks this coming weekend. Torrence, this is a team that has managed to boast a top five defense without Kawhi, and despite having their share of offensive struggles, have still managed to weather the storm through the first quarter of the year with the help of James Harden, Ivica Zubac, and Norman Powell, who could be a dark horse contender for the Most Improved Player Award, albeit in his 10th season. When you look at this Clippers roster with a healthy Kawhi in the mix, how far do you believe this team could go in the postseason?
You're gonna keep trying to get these old guys that Most Improved Player award. I see what you're trying to do, but it's not gonna work, bro. They ain't changed. They not changing that award. That's not how they do that. But I respect it though. I know you're trying to figure out a way to give somebody their flowers, but nah, bro. That's not that award for him. But Norman Powell, shout out to him. He definitely doing his thing. He's definitely been a great Kawhi replacement. Look, man, this Kawhi Leonard question is redundant, man. Like, we know he gonna come back. He gonna go crazy, because that's what Kawhi does. Robot Jordan, he got a lot of nicknames. The Claw. He one of my favorite players to watch. Like, game very simple. Dominate from the free throw line with the mid-range jumper. But, man, look, they a first or second round exit. That's what the Clippers do. That's who the Clippers are. I don't want to talk about what I think may happen with Kawhi when he comes back. I don't want to jinx nobody, but we've been watching the same story for the last 4 to 5 years.
You know, for me, it all come down to matchups at the end of the day. And the Clippers roster, I think with a healthy Kawhi in the fold, pending on the matchups, can do well. But
What's well? What's
as
well?
always, well, for them, getting to the conference finals would be an achievement.
You
But
believe
the
they can
likely
do that?
I'm cannot finish.
Now, do you believe they can do that?
The likelihood, I would say, is slim because they don't have the most important thing on their side whenever they do have good teams and make a run, and that's health. That's health. I look at this team as a team that's Western Conference semifinals bound if things go right. But if
I don't
not,
think if
yeah,
they
they
healthy,
could get.
they could do it. I don't think if they healthy, they could do it.
Well, that's fine. And I mean, I understand it's the Clippers. They a lot of people shit on them, and they are the second team in the second city. But I think that this is a team that at best, yeah, they probably will get to the second round and get dispatched. They could be a dark horse for the Western Conference Finals, depending on how the matchups shake out. That's just my thoughts on it.
I'm just going off top of my head, matchup for matchup. I just don't see them beating certain teams that's above them at this point. I mean, Kawhi and James Harden, they these guys in their mid-30s. What they doing is incredible. But hey, man, they legs old, just like Bron, Steph, and KD, and them like legs old, and all them guys fighting for a play-in spot right now.
Well, let me ask you this. We know that Clippers owner Steve Ballmer is always more than willing to make necessary upgrades when the opportunity presents itself. Whether that's him making a call to go from the Crypto.com arena to the $2 billion palace known as the Intuit Dome out in Inglewood, or being willing to push the button on the James Harden trade a year ago. Many may have opinions on his business practices as it pertains to the team. However, one can't question his commitment to winning at this point. Do you expect the Clippers to be aggressive buyers at the trade deadline? Because you got a lot of people, you had a lot of people prior to the season saying that, hey, It's time for you to blow this up. However, this team has come together and been more than just respectable, but a team that stands among the middle of the pack in the Western Conference standings.
No, I don't think the Clippers doing anything. Kawhi is the move. And if Kawhi don't come back and make it work, then so be it. Like, at this point, the way that the Clippers got their contract set up on their team, they clearly are shooting for 2027. Yeah, that's when Kawhi is on the last year of his deal. James Harden, his contract expires the year before. And if at that point, he'll be, what, 37 years old? So, I mean, at the most, they might give him another 1 or 2 years, but they won't be at the same price he's making now. So, right now, I don't see the Clippers making any significant moves. You know, they got guys that they taking a chance on, like Bones Highland, Amir Coffey, Kobe Brown, Kevin Porter Jr. So, that's about it. Oh, PJ Tucker still there.
I expect the Clippers to make a move. I don't know how aggressive of a move, but I have a player that I think would be a great fit for them. Guy that I didn't even get a chance to really highlight too much, if at all, on last week's episode. And that's Nikola Vucevic. He's currently averaging nearly 21 points per game. He's averaging 10 rebounds per game. He's shooting almost 57% from the field. And on top of that, he's shooting 45.3% from long range. I think he can make for a nice stretch four for the Clippers to have and complement Ivica Zubac's game in the front court at the five spot rather well. I really think he'd be a great pickup for them. He's only due, I believe, $20 million this season, with 21.4 on the books for next year, and his contract is set to expire after that. That's a deal that they can make, and it could be a low-risk, high-reward move. You know, he fits the Harden and Kawhi window as far as contracts are structured. Why not take a chance on a guy like Nikola Vucevic, whose market is probably not going to be that hot to where everybody is going to want him. So I would look at Nikola Vucevic if I was the Clippers. I'm pretty sure a team like the Golden State Warriors would be interested in Nikola Vucevic as well. They've been rumored and reported to, according to a lot of people that I know that's tight on the Bulls media scene. Shout out to my man Drew Stevens with the bigs. But yeah, I like the Clippers to make a move, if not a couple. You know, and Nikola Vucevic is one of those guys that I can see being a target of theirs, and I think he could fit perfect in Tyronn Lue's system.
Man, I like Vooch for them, but the Bulls not fooling me. I don't believe they'll make a trade when they make it. But the idea of them having another center that can get buckets, because Zubac, he be putting some points up some nights. So
yes, he is.
That'll be cool. We know James works well with a lot of centers. So, I mean, they might be another team you could see throw into that Rob Williams situation. Like I said, they got the PJ Tucker contract. The Terrence Mann, I don't anticipate them trading him. He kind of like a Clipper lifer over there at this point. So, well, but I don't really see them doing anything significant, man. It's certain teams, like I said, man, they just letting these old guys ride off into the sunset semi-competitive. Yeah, we're not going to spend luxury tax money to get you to the finals. But, hey, you will have a chance at the play-in. This thing going to go as far as you push it. Play-in or no playoffs. You determine when your work schedule over. But that June, we ain't doing that no more. We're not spending that June money no more.
I'll say this. I wanted to say this in regards to the point you made earlier about Norman Powell. The reason why Norman Powell has a case for most improved player in my book, he's upped his points per game total like plus 10.3, I believe, this season. That's the biggest jump of any player in the league right now. of any player. And I know he's 31 years of age, but you got to tip your cap to this dude, man. And he's finally getting an opportunity in the starting five, and he's thriving in it. The most improved player of the year award, last time I checked, it wasn't an award that was meant for top lottery picks to always win. It was meant for players that show improvement over the course of a calendar year to obtain. Regardless of what status they were in the league, be it as a young player or a player that was in year 8 or 10 of their career.
I mean, I feel you. Like I said, man, he deserves something for just carrying the weight of replacing Kawhi while he's allowed to get time to get healthy. He's done his thing. But at the same time, hey, man, that might sometimes that's enough. Like, bro, you got more shots this year, bro. Didn't you have more fun this year? You got to shoot the ball a lot more. You might even make more money now because, hey, you did do your thing when you got the opportunity. But we're going to get an award to somebody that's probably in year 5 and down. Keep tradition going.
Well, for those who don't know, Norm Powell is on pace to become the third player in NBA history, 6'4" or shorter, to average at least 24 points per game or more on a 63% true shooting percentage or better for a season, joining Stephen Curry and Damian Lillard in that category. So, when you add all that up and you put it into full perspective, he's a guy that has to be in the running. I know Jalen Johnson's name is going to be in the mix. He probably should have won most improved player last year, if you ask me, but over Tyrese Maxey. No disrespect to Tyrese Maxey, but
Evan Mobley, I Kay Cunningham.
Him. Yeah, Evan Mobley, Kay. But you see, this is the thing. I just want to say something real quick before we move on to the next topic about that. Evan Mobley and Cade Cunningham were top three picks in the 2021 NBA draft class. They were guys that were looked at by scouts that I know that scouted them as guys that could potentially be game changers on a franchise. Their improvement was expected by me, at least, if no one else.
We got a lot of top three picks that's I don't know, bust, flunked out, whatever.
That's true.
So, whatever pick you get picked at, that's one thing. But once you step into the league, you at a blank slate, and we judging you year by year. And you got about a good 4 to 5 year window to make these leaps to get that award. Norman Powell? Hey, bro, hey. You've been doing your thing, but with the last few winners we got with Ja Morant, Lauri Markkanen, Tyrese Maxey, like the one exception was like Julius Randle and Brandon Ingram, but they also got traded to new situations, and that played into the narrative of the award as well. But for the most part, like I keep reiterating, that's a young man's award.
I'm not...
You get MVPs around like between year 7 to 10. You get rookie of the year, obviously, your first year. That most improved, that's for like your 3 through 5.
Yeah, but there's also some special situations that you have to account for sometimes. And as a voter or someone that may be listening to this show, I will hope that they account for that when they vote this year. Because you have a veteran in Los Angeles that should at least be within the top 3 or 4 in consideration for most improved player. I'm sorry. But let's lead the franchises in the state of California, where Motown resides, to discuss the basketball team that hails in the city where the iconic label originated in Detroit, and that's the Pistons, a team that lost a record 28 consecutive games from October 30th through December 30th last season, but is currently making a very strong case to go from the NBA's laughing stock to a team on the rise. The Pistons, who won just 14 games a season ago, have successfully matched last year's win total, went into the new year Under head coach J.B. Bickerstaff, has produced a feel-good outcome for a team that hasn't had many over recent years in his first season out in the Motor City, as the Pistons currently sit in the 10th and final play-in spot in the Eastern Conference going into the new year, led behind the play of guards Jaden Ivey and Malik Beasley, in addition to rising star Cade Cunningham, who in his fourth year with the franchise is providing fans in the 313 with a majestic campaign to remember. Is the man who inked the 5 years, $224 million extension over this summer, currently averaging 24 points, 9.7 assists, and 6.7 boards per game on the year for Detroit, and appears destined to make his first All-Star appearance in just a couple of months. Torrence, the Pistons may not be a team that's atop of the majority of NBA power rankings just yet. However, one could say that they're within close proximity of being regarded as an average club, a strong leap forward from where they stood approximately a year ago this time. They're coming off a four-game West Coast road trip where they posted a 3-1 record and captured wins against the Phoenix Suns, the Lakers, and the Kings in a thrilling affair where Ivy led a 17-6 Pistons run prior to hitting a clutch tray in the corner and route to a four-point play late to officially seal the deal. Detroit will open up the new year with eight of their first 10 games at home against likely lottery-bound teams ranging from Portland, Charlotte, Brooklyn, and Toronto. In your own words, what do you believe has led to the Pistons' sudden turnaround? And is this a team that you believe has what it takes to make the play-in it's currently constructed?
Well, we stood up and defended coaches earlier, and we defended black coaches specifically. But the biggest improvement for the Detroit Pistons is getting rid of Monty Williams and putting J.B. Bickerstaff in us. They have a coach that cares now. They have to force Monty to take that job. Monty had to get the richest contract for a coach in NBA history to take that job. That man wasn't trying to coach no more. But he took one for the he took one for the team, because immediately after that, Spoelstra, Steve Kerr, hey, people clearly called their agents and said, well, if he can get that money, it's time to up mine. And he figured out a way to raise the bar for the coaches. So I'm sure in their community, shout out to him. But he got that job, and he was cool on it. He didn't put a lot of faith and confidence into the young guys. Like, Jaden Ivey's having a much better year. I know Kay Cunningham was dealing with injuries. That hurt the team a lot. But Monty didn't want that job. Now, a part of the reason he didn't want that job, and I'll make this my second point, is Monty wanted to coach vets. And that's what they added this season with Malik Beasley, Tim Hardaway Jr., and Tobias Harris. It got guys who can also knock down shots for Cade Cunningham, you know, who's a guy that likes to do a lot of drive and kick and work from the middle of the court, a lot, kind of like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. So those are the two big things now.
I think having J.B. Bickerstaff has done a load of wonders for the Detroit Pistons. He came in from the door and let dudes know off the top, like, hey, don't be wearing hoodies in my practice. Like, we got to put in the work.
That was
goofy. You can say whatever you want about it. I don't give a damn. Sometimes you got to set the tone with motherfuckers.
Yeah,
And you know that. I don't care. I don't care what you like about it. He let them know. And guys were receptive to it. Kay Cunningham was one of them. It was like, hey, look. We hit a win game. Let's make it happen.
We're talking about
J.B. Bickerstaff has played a tremendous part in that, and he's gotten guys to buy in to end of the floor that last year they struggled in, and that's defense. Now, yeah, if you look at the metrics, they still not up there among the top of the top teams in defense. But late in games, they're getting enough stops to keep themselves within games, and also they're learning how to close out games. Something that J.B. Bickerstaff brought to a young Cleveland roster when he first got over there. You know, he's a guy that knows how to work the young players and is willing to meet them on their level somewhat and show them some things along the way that he's learned throughout his various stops in the league. You add that on top of the fact that they got veterans in there, like you alluded to, veterans that have played in winning environments and that have been in Eastern Conference Finals and NBA Finals, such as Tim Hardaway with the Dallas Mavericks before he went there. Guys that can knock down shots and boost K's confidence up to trust them with the game on the line, is he's a guy that likes to dish it out when the double teams come, they collapse in the paint against him on drive and kicks. It's leading to a lot of success. And I give a ton of credit to a guy like Malik Beasley, who fits very well alongside of Cade due to his ability to move off of the ball and knock down shots on the move. He's not your traditional catch and shoot 3-point option. So when I look at Detroit and I look at what's led to the turnaround, I'm seeing a group of young guys that actually believe and they're learning how to close out games. And this, in my opinion, is what makes watching NBA basketball fun, is when you see young teams go from not knowing how to win to learning how to win. And as a result, you see their confidence increase and you see them take that next step, because everybody ain't going to be a championship contender in year one or year two right away. It takes time, and it's a journey, and it's a process to building. You're seeing that right now in Detroit. And as a result, you're looking at a team that's on the verge of making an upward transcendence atop of the standings.
Yeah, man. Like, all that gimmicky stuff that JB Bickerstaff doing, that's cool. Now it works at this point. But this is also the same reason that bites them in the end as these teams develop and these same young guys don't need you to do all of that to get your point across. Right now is good. Right now it seems that he's helping the team, but we'll see where this leads to them down the road.
Well, over time, coaches' philosophies can change, Tony. I mean, you don't have to be the way you are 1 year, the next year. It can always change. And part of being on a team is learning how to follow some form of structure. That's all he providing them with. And there's nothing wrong with that, considering where they started or where they were a year ago.
They didn't have a coach last year.
And now they got one. And guess what? He got rules and some regulations to it. So what's wrong with that? But I want to ask you this. The Pistons currently do have the most cap space out of any team in the league as we speak, and they can make a move at the deadline and acquire a piece if necessary. Do you think that they should seek to get aggressive at the trade deadline? And if so, which player do you believe they should target in your eyes to help the franchise get over the hump and into the playoffs for the first time since 2019?
As we spoke on last week, the guy that they should be trying to go get, my opinion, is Brandon Ingram. If you really wanted to swing for the fences, then skip over Brandon Ingram and go after Zion Williamson. Somebody that can really just – you slide them right into that Tobias Harris spot or Tim Hardaway, because those guys, they're doing great right now, but they're not going to be there for the long term. Hopefully the Thompson twin, he continues to develop. He can step into that spot. Jaden Ivey develops, Jalen Durant. So that 3-4 spot, that's where you can make the upgrade at. And those are the two guys that are pretty much the most available and looking for somebody to pay them. Now, do you want to make the Charlie Villanueva, Ben Gordon mistake that they once made? Even the Blake Griffin trade, Blake was killing it in Detroit, but they were perennial eighth seed. You got to give yourself a chance to get to that top half. So you got to swing hard. I don't know if those are really the best moves, but like I said, they have the money available.
See, the Blake Griffin situation was always interesting when they made that trade to me because of his contract. And like you said, things were good when they were good, but when the injuries mounted up, that was a tough contract to move, and it became a burden on their front office over there in Detroit. But when I look at the Pistons, and I'm glad you brought up Ausar Thompson, because that's a guy I think once he tightens up his hand, the sky's the limit for him. I think they should get a little bit aggressive at this deadline. And going after a guy like Brandon Ingram, he's on an expiring deal, I don't think that would be a bad move at all. I think he would actually be a perfect fit in the city of Detroit. And or getting a guy like Zion Williamson, like you said, if you want to swing for the fences, we agree on those guys. Those are guys they should definitely target, because it's not like you're in a market where you're going to attract free agents. It's some big games on the Week 11 docket that fans should have their eyes on as we enter into 2025, with a couple of matchups that will feature some of the game's premier stars. After losing with a shot to win it on the final possession in their most recent matchup out in Beantown, Anthony Edwards and the Minnesota Timberwolves will seek to get payback in front of their home fans this time around in the second and final installment of their regular season series against Jason Tatum and the Celtics out in downtown Minneapolis at the Target Center in the first game of the NBA on TNT Thursday night doubleheader, going down at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 6:30 p.m. Central Time, followed by Tyrese Maxey and the Philadelphia 76ers heading out to the Bay to square off against Stephen Curry and the Golden State Warriors in a nightcap matchup at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. Our NBA TV will feature an interconference showdown between a pair of teams who are currently sitting among the top three of their respective conferences on Friday night, as the big bodega himself, Karl-Anthony Towns, will lead the New York Knicks in one of the NBA's toughest environments, Oklahoma City, square off against Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and the Thunder in a battle between two MVP candidates. That game, which will be the first half of a back-to-back road set for the Knicks over the weekend, is set to tip off at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central Time. These are just a few matchups as we know that fans will likely be watching, Torrance. Which ones do you have on your radar to check out for yourself in week 11?
All right, Friday, I'm gonna start my night watching the two worst teams in the NBA play, the Washington Wizards and the New Orleans Pelicans. There's no reason for me to ever watch these two teams, so might as well kill two birds with one stone, watching both at the same time, form my opinion that I'm gonna keep for the rest of the season. And Saturday, I mean, this probably is just, it's Saturday, the most important thing. The New York Knicks at the Chicago Bulls, Derrick Rose night in Chicago. They're not retiring his jersey. I don't understand why, but if you understand Chicago sports and Chicago sports ownership, they probably trying to milk that for another day to make money down the line. But it's Derrick Rose night. I guess it symbolizes the numbers he's worn throughout his career. Of course, number one, number four, and number 25. Back in Simeon, where he, created the beginning of his legend. I mean, this is the Chicago, as the kids say. And it's going to be a great night in the city. Hopefully, the Bulls can take the Knicks down, as they've done historically, at least in my eyes. Because, I mean, they're pretty much the same franchise, the Bulls and the Knicks. The only difference is one has Michael Jordan and one got Patrick Ewing. And that's all you need to know about me and what I'm riding for. So, and speaking of the Bulls, Monday night, we got Victor Wembanyama and the Spurs. They come into Chicago. I'm looking forward to that matchup as well, because at this point in the season, we a third of the way through. And when you start looking at the standings, you can start to eliminate teams at this point. We know not making the playoffs. We got the Pelicans, the Utah Jazz, the Portland Trail Blazers. And I probably at this point might even say the Sacramento Kings, barring injury. The Washington Wizards, the Toronto Raptors, the Charlotte Hornets, and the Brooklyn Nets. Spurs, Bulls. Hey, let's just see which team could take a game like this and go into the second half of the season and really start to climb up the standings. They both are pretty much fighting for play-in spots, both at the number nine spots in the East and West. So I'm looking forward to that matchup. I know that was a lot to say in between, but just want to kind of like let people know at what point of the season we at, because we had the Christmas Day games, and this is kind of like when the games really start to matter and teams have, like, you know, worked themselves into shape. They got a little bit of chemistry. We making a few trades to clean up things on the edges. And just want to give a shout out to, you know, the teams towards the bottom of the playoff race.
I'm glad that you brought up Derrick Rose night here in the city of Wynn. That's going to be a big night. And I'm glad that he's getting his flowers and it's just due. Even though he's not getting his number retired, I do expect for him to get his number retired above the Raptors at the United Center at some point. It just has to happen. It has to happen. And I don't know when, but at some point sooner rather than later, it has to happen. My games of the week to watch. I don't know how you're going to make it through that Washington New Orleans one, but good luck to you. But my game on that Friday evening will be an 8:30 Eastern time tip-off and a 7:30 p.m. Central time tip-off. And it's a game that's going down in the Metroplex between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Dallas Mavericks. The Dallas Mavericks recently lost Luka Doncic for over a month due to a strained left calf that he suffered on Christmas Day prior to the half against the Minnesota Timberwolves. They have lost two games in a row, and they recently fell to Sacramento at the top of this week. Kyrie Irving, we know, is one of the game's premier guards and premier players, and we're going to get a chance to see just how far he can continue to keep Dallas atop of the standings, alongside of Klay Thompson and other guys on their roster, such as Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford, who've been playing some good basketball as of late. I want to see how they play and measure up against the best team in the league right now in the Cleveland Cavaliers and Donovan Mitchell. And I'm sure that the Mavs and their faithful are going to be out loud and rowdy in the Metroplex for that contest. I think that'll be an exciting game, as you have three guards that, if you're a guard enthusiast like I am, who you can study and track throughout the night with Donovan Mitchell, Kyrie Irving, as well as Darius Garland, who's been playing some really great basketball in his own right after the last couple of seasons having some ups and downs with injuries and the like. And then the other game that I'm looking forward to watching on Friday night at the Boston Celtics, going on the road to take on the Houston Rockets. You know, these are two teams that have a lot of history with one another, dating all the way back to the 80s. And now you got Ime Udoka, a guy who led the Celtics to the finals a couple of seasons ago, going toe-to-toe against some of his former mates in Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and the like. And they find a way to get a statement win at home against one of the premier teams in the league. Let's find out. That game is going to be tipping off at 8 p.m. Eastern time, 7 p.m. Central time, going down at the Toyota Center in downtown Houston. So those are the games that I'll be watching in week 11.
You said the 80s. You said the 80s, man. Give us a brief history on the Celtics and the Rockets history that's dating back to the 80s.
Well, they made up in the finals twice that decade. They did. And they did. Boston won both series in six games. For those who don't know, Larry Bird won two out of his three finals against the Houston Rockets. So those teams, those
Hakeem was there.
Hakeem was there in 86. Yes, he was. So Moses Malone, the late Moses Malone, rest in peace, was there.
So Hakeem got to the finals before Mike did.
Sure did. For those that don't know, that's a fact.
And Mike ducked the smoke twice in the 90s. and see, people never mentioned that Mike got picked third, Hakeem went one, and you never hear people be like, well, Mike should have went one. You never hear that. They just be like Sam Bowie. Yeah, Mike know how to keep that African man out his narrative, don't he?
Well, it don't matter. I mean, I say this much. You go to Houston,
No, it matter.
Olajuwon is a god down there.
As he should be, man. As he should be.
Absolutely.
Shout out to Ime Udoka, though.
Oh, for sure. But with all of that said, that officially concludes this week's edition of the New 24 podcast. Thank you very much for taking out your time to open up the new year by listening to us, wherever you may be doing so across the globe. If you've enjoyed what you've heard in this episode, including through the first seven episodes prior to this one, for all of the listeners who've been dialed in every week, and we appreciate you. Please leave us a five-star rating on whichever podcasting platform you listen to the show on to stay up to date on all that encompasses the NBA, in addition to also subscribing to our RSS feed as well to ensure you don't miss out on future episodes set to drop every Wednesday morning throughout the course of the regular season. You will also be able to find all episodes there at rss.com/podcast/TNTF. You can also follow us if you're on X as well at What Gabe Said, GAVE, and Torrance himself at TStacks_STACKS. If you'd like to engage and interact with us on dialogue pertaining to the game and more, for myself, Gabriel Wilkins, and my co-host, Torrance Stagger, Happy New Year, everybody. Peace.